Okay, welcome back, and thank you for making it on time. So we are going to move on to our next session. First up is going to be Barry Childs. I think the gentleman needs no introduction. He's the joint CEO of Insight Actuaries and Consultants. He was also past chair of the Healthcare Committee. And he guided us quite well during the COVID pandemic. We saw the amount of work that was done through the Actuarial Society during that time. And his topic is around the healthcare system development. So he has titled it Regulatory Update and Health System Development. How can we build a more sustainable model? I cannot think of any speaker who would be more apt to talk about it. It's quite a challenging subject, and it's a subject where it will be difficult to find answers. So I'm looking forward to Barry's talk. So you can put him on, please. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Hope you can see and hear me. Apologies that I'm joining you virtually today to give this talk. I have a birthday in the family, so decided to stay in Cape Town to celebrate. But nonetheless, here we are. I look forward to your questions. And I hope you find the talk useful. So I was asked to speak on, to give a regulatory update, to speak a bit about health system development, and then this very broad open-ended question, how can we build a more sustainable model? And I have some suggestions for that as we go. So just touching first on the financing regulation, I wanted to cover some history. I was reminded very recently by some Insight staff just how very old I am. Emil making the point about hair sort of was a stark reminder of my lack of hair, and fortunately having hair is neither a necessary nor sufficient condition to be a genius. Another correlation lesson there. But I did think, depending on who's in the audience from the different firms and professionals that participate in the healthcare space, that a very brief run through of the history is useful for the sake of posterity. When we think about healthcare policy in South Africa, obviously very different way it plays out in public and private sectors. But we've always favored bold plans. You know, we have a lot of problems to fix, and in order to fix those problems, you need bold plans, very much like a bold business strategy. We really have important things to do and important problems to solve, and that requires boldness. Unfortunately, we've also seen that those are not supported by the incremental steps required for success. And so, you know, it's one thing to have a great plan, but without the necessary steps to understand how to get from A to B, you really aren't going to get there. And all you're left with is a wonderful plan. And we've seen this time and time again. One example is NHI, which I'll talk about some more later. Another example is the Human Resources for Health strategy. Which, you know, every time that strategy is refreshed, it's pretty much a copy and paste of the previous one because nothing really happened in between. And we're in this dynamic where, because we have, you know, such a lot to do and have these big reforms to make, that because we worry about never finishing the reforms, if we only make these incremental steps, then we end up not really even starting the reforms, because the steps that we impose on ourselves to get from A to B are too large. Even to take the first one. And that's another good example of why NHI hasn't really manifest in the way that it was envisaged. We have close on 40 years, probably more, depending on how loose you want to make the definition, of unfulfilled universal health coverage reforms. It's been on the table since at least 1994. And whenever you mention this word, everybody agrees with the principles, but we don't agree on how to get there. And so we go round and round the merry-go-round, fighting about how to improve the healthcare system. And in the interim, very, very little actually changes. In the private sector, we have, again, at least 20 years of incomplete and ambling private sector regulation. We're talking about PMB updates, which, you know, have hardly happened, certainly not the way that they were intended to happen. We have this insurance demarcation debate, some of which battles have been lost and not revived, some of which battles continue. There have been no material updates to the PMDs since 2003. No space in the Medical Schemes Act for thinking about incentives, wellness programs, behavior improvement, etc. All the things that we know are in line with the, I don't want to say recent thinking, certainly current thinking, but I mean, we've known this stuff for a long time. And the fact that we aren't able to effectively build these into the risk pooling framework is a massive barrier for progress and a better healthcare system. So on the financing, financing regulation, obviously we have the NHI bill, which dominates everybody's thinking. The HMI, the Health Market Inquiry, is almost forgotten. We hope that some of the findings will, you know, still make their way into consideration and some kind of practicality. There were some interesting suggestions that they put forward. But how long ago was it? You know, when last did the HMI come up in conversations, you know, in your buildings with your clients in front of your medical schemes? It's almost, you know, a forgotten piece of work. That's a great tragedy. Now everybody's focused on the NHI bill currently under parliamentary review. Probably the best place, if you haven't seen the YouTube clips of the parliamentary hearings and people's submissions, you can go to HASA's website, Hospital Association of South Africa. They put a really nice page together compiling all the different days that everybody came and spoke. The Actuarial Society made a submission which was in line with our written submission, just a rehash of that. But there were some quite good ones. But it's very plain to see big differences in ideology drive differences in views about how best to achieve a more equitable healthcare system and universal healthcare coverage. I certainly anticipate that it will be highly contested, and the details will be highly fought over as the rollout to NHI. On low cost benefit options, demarcation exemption framework, prescribed minimum review and costing. I thought that a picture actually isn't enough to do it justice, so I thought I'd play you this video. Painfully slow to watch. Long periods of silence, really, really disappointing at the slow pace with which any progress is being made there. And I say that being a participant on the PMB Review Costing Committee. I say that being on one of the LCBO task teams. It's just unbelievably slow and painful. I sort of have some fond memories of the level of contention, but speed with which we were able to attack regulatory issues back in the early 2000s, even though there were lots of contentious issues at play. And we seem to have lost that sort of technical robustness and rigor to engage in industry debates to make progress. Talking a little bit more about NHI, the current conversation is something like this. You know, we've got it. There's enough money in the country to fund NHI. I'm leaving off of the table for now this idea that the NHI would be able to absorb medical scheme reserves. Because I think that lawyers will tie that up in court for many, many years. But there's a very real conversation that says we actually have enough money to fund NHI if we add the current public health budget tax credits, government subsidy of public sector schemes. This is the GEMSes, the PolMeds, maybe the Selgas, maybe the parastatals, who knows, of the world. Road Accident Fund, compensation funds. There is a lot of money around in these funds. And that's the current rhetoric, for people that are pro NHI, that actually, you know, you could whip up an NHI from a funding point of view in a sustainable way if you were able to pool all of this money. The tax expenditure subsidy on its own, I think, is going to be cannon fodder for the NHI. I think it's easy for policymakers to make a grab for it, which is about 30 billion rand. Work there shows that it will worsen the regressivity within the medical scheme population because it's a fixed amount. The subsidy is effectively a larger contribution in percentage terms for lower income households and on lower cost plans. Will worsen the missing middle people that are on the affordability threshold of medical schemes, because it's not clear what will happen to their employer subsidies. And the real question then is, if you're taking away with the one hand, is there something that you're giving with the other hand in compensation? So is there an NHI net that will catch them? And will the timing be coordinated sufficiently to give those people protection? So, it would be the worst thing, for example, if you get that timing right, where you first need to say, well, give us the 30 billion first, and we'll roll out some equivalent benefit to you as a net in, 5 years' time or whenever. The overall public health budget, call it, is 230 billion rand now. GEMS and Pol Med together are about 60 billion in gross contribution income per year, maybe another 10 billion for SALGA schemes. Parastatals will be a bit smaller than that. So you can understand this argument. I haven't put the road accident fund and the compensation fund amounts there, although the coupon amounts of contribution are quite small. But you can sort of see the argument taking shape. Our concern on the public sector medical scheme side, and we consult with some of these clients and have been in the rooms with employers, been in the rooms with unions, and their representatives, etc., is those are hard-fought subsidies. And again, it must be clear here, it's not, let's say the subsidy is 3,000 rand a month. You can't take away the subsidy and replace it with cash, because that increases net expenditure from Treasury, the public sector wage bill effectively, for which there's no more room to do that. So you have to be, if you want this money, you have to be able to take it away and replace it with something else that doesn't cost anymore. And that is supposed to be the NHI. Now, again, the problem is, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about can you spot the difference on the left, the toucan picture, where it's almost the same? I've substituted... I've taken away your medical scheme, but don't worry, I'm giving you NHI with only some very subtle differences. I promise you it's almost the same. Is it that situation, or is it the other situation where this is a bird and that's also a bird on the right-hand side? And what we're worried about, and what the unions and the employers are worried about, is that the substitution is going to be something more akin to what's on the right, as opposed to the minus what the difference is on the left. So that is a really, really big concern, and we think is going to be a battleground in some of the contention around NHI. Okay, on the demarcation side, just to trot through that quickly, it's really become quite a complex market when we think about it from a pooled healthcare financing point of view. We've had the opportunity to take a little bit of a step back and think about actually where we are, as opposed to just look at each of the individual products and what's happening there. So actually we have this conglomerate of healthcare financing options. Now you have gap cover, which, people take for granted as a well-established, legitimized market. It wasn't so 15 years ago. It was highly contested, went to court, and because of, the smallest of wording and grammar mistakes in the Medical Schemes Act, was allowed to continue. Now, if you were in the good old days, the way a regulator would have dealt with that would have been to say, okay, well, I see the problem in the Act. I'm going to fix that in the next publication of the Act, and then I'll come back to the market, take them to court again, and say, you're doing the business of a medical scheme and you must cease to operate. That hasn't happened. Now we have who knows how large gap cover market, many hundreds of thousands of policies, probably more, perhaps in the millions. No one really knows. That's another conundrum. And they compete, in a sense, with schemes that pay at higher specialist rates and have fewer and options that have fewer co-payments. You could buy the lower plan and buy a gap cover. This is a well-established tactic that brokers use to upsell and get more commission. It drives some buy-down behavior at schemes. There's not really good alignment between insurer and medical scheme, etc. So really, even that on its own has become complex, although we've become used to it now in the market. Primary health insurance is heading for the same. If we continue on the way that we're going, we're in this perpetually extended exemption mode. In our view, it makes no sense for schemes not to be able to offer comparable products with the same exemption framework. And we're actually surprised that there hasn't been a stronger legal challenge yet to say, actually, hold on, I'm a self-administered medical scheme, say, and I want to also offer a product in this space within my framework. Why should you give exemption to this entity and not us? So lots of peculiarity on the way that that market has evolved and developed, but now it is a thriving market. There are hundreds of thousands of policies. Again, nobody knows exactly how many. We hope to know later in the year. But it's an established market. It's a legitimized market. And the only question will be where it ends up. Is it going to be only in the medical scheme space? Is it going to be only in the insurance space? Or is it going to be in both of those places? And that we don't know. So maybe medical cover of the future will be hybrid. You know, maybe you'll be buying a hospital plan that pays specialists only at standard rates. You'll buy a primary health insurance cover for your sort of day-to-day needs, and gap cover if you're seeing doctors that charge at higher rates. Now, this causes all sorts of problems. I mean, the upsides are flexibility and expanded choice. You're not locked into one provider necessarily, but there's a massive increase in complexity, administrative complexity for the individual. You know, the insurers don't still play by quite the same rules. There's more stringent underwriting. Some gap cover products stop when you're 65, and that's when you tend to go to the specialist to need more care. And so you may be out of pocket there, which is why they can compete at lower prices on a not level playing field. It increases the risk of anti-selection. There's significant admin inefficiency. Each of these parties will need their own admin fee. They'll need to process the claim themselves. They'll need to, figure out why this entity paid and not that entity paid. Where should the bill be sent if you've got all three coverages? Should it, which insurer should it go to? It becomes really, really messy. Significant regulatory uncertainty. And also capital inefficiency, because each of these entities, because of the fragmented risk pools, will need to hold their own capital. So really not an ideal environment from an actuarial point of view, although technically interesting. Not ideal from a risk pooling point of view, stability, regulatory fairness, etc. Unfortunately, this is the direction that we're heading at the moment. Within the medical scheme space, The two main problems: the PMB reform, when it was originally promulgated, was supposed to happen every 2 to 3 years. The current PMB reform process, which is yet to be completed, started when — now this is when I was in the audience. I'd love sort of a show of hands. I should have done a survey, I suppose, to guess when the one that we're in right now, when it started. If it's supposed to have been done every 2 years, I'll give you a couple of minutes to write it down on a piece of paper. And the answer is 2016. So 6 years ago, just the current process, which doesn't seem to be near completion, because the next steps would be publication of a draft report for industry comment and feedback, and then go back to the committees and we'd have to think about what the industry said and all these kind of things. I mean, I don't think we're closer than another 2 years away from finalizing any kind of PMB reform updates. It may even be a 10-year cycle, which would mean that if we're going to reform PMBs regularly, we would need to run multiple processes in parallel, one ignoring the other, so that we would be able to. It's just absurd, we're really nowhere. And a key driver of this is just the massive trajectory uncertainty that NHI has brought. And I'll touch on that in a little while. The bigger picture, coming back again to the sort of, I couldn't think of the metaphor I wanted to use yet, the drum we've been beating or the harp that we've been playing over the past sort of 20 years, is that medical schemes still operate in an incomplete regulatory environment. We have no mandatory membership and we have no risk equalization, which are critical risk mitigation regulatory structures required to balance out open enrollment and community rating. And we don't have them. And so, every year there's a moan about our contribution increases are going up faster than inflation. Why is it? It must be the hospitals that are driving, that are profiteering, or it must be the administrators, or it must be such and such financial institution keeping all of the money for itself. When we know with many studies, some of which we've done, some of which other folk have done, that contributions could be significantly lower if we were allowed to implement these reforms. The one I've put in grey, the income cross subsidies, is sort of the stepchild of the regulatory completeness, which isn't much spoken about, but is also critical. What you really need to prop the industry up correctly is proper income cross subsidies. At the moment, we are conflating income cross subsidies and risk cross subsidies. So the wealthier tend to be older, tend to be sicker, tend to be on higher income options. They don't necessarily provide their fair share from an income cross subsidy point of view. And there is more that could be done there, but that's perhaps a talk or a paper all on its own. I just wanted to mention it here. So in terms of this part of this complexity is wrapped up in the political landscape. The question for us, at least from a medical scheme point of view, is where does the CMS fit in? If you think about the history, before 2007, medical schemes were intended to be a vital part of social health insurance and a vital part of progressing towards universal health coverage. And that is the reason why we have the regulatory environment we have, even though it wasn't completed. And it's the reason why CMS was established in the way that it was, with the power that it was, to be this quite heavy-handed micromanaging regulator. You don't see nearly the kind of detail regulation in the FSCA and the Prudential Authority than you do in the CMS. It's just a different order of magnitude. So this focus on solidarity principles, open enrollment, community rating, not-for-profit, that all comes from this idea that medical schemes would be a pillar towards reaching an NHR or UHC objective. And into 2007, we had this policy shift at Polokwane to move to NHI as opposed to using schemes, and schemes would become less and less relevant over time. So the question now is, does it make more sense for medical schemes and health insurers to be regulated in Twin Peaks kind of style, FSCA kind of style? And what is then CMS's place in the world within the Department of Health? What is their role, given that they've been driving an agenda of consolidation, been driving an agenda of not approving exemptions, for example, bargaining council schemes, they've been giving them a hard time. Making it increasingly difficult for schemes to operate while at the same time not supporting reforms that would improve scheme operations. So the question is, how does the CMS position itself in that world also? One way to talk about that is anticipatory obedience, my colleague Christoph would call it, which is to say, no one really knows what the future looks like, so we'll act in a way that we think it's going to play out and will help us to look good in the future. Those of you that have been interacting with the CMS understand that it's becoming more bureaucratic, less discretionary. They have struggled with resources over time, even if you read the reports, if you've been interacting with them. And that just means that there's less applying of mind and more about, well, this is what the rule says, this is how you must go about it. And it just makes the whole process, much more difficult. Certainly stifles innovation, etc. A narrow view on exemptions, this in exceptional cases, so loosely defined, but again, ironically, coming back to the discretionary side of things, that means that the default answer is no. I mentioned already the bargaining council schemes, etc. The question is, NHI is coming in some shape or form, but what happens in the meanwhile? We're carrying on exactly the same in unsustainable kind of way that we've been going in. So that is really a scramble to keep schemes afloat. In terms of health system development, I wanted to play a bit of bingo quickly. I could have listed all of these things, but I thought I would try to string as many together as I could in one or two sentences. We need to improve health system development, strengthen health systems would be the way that the public sector would talk about it, by using more value-based care in our strategic purchasing efforts, making sure that our benefits are patient-centered, sharing value between all the different stakeholders with aligned incentives wrapped in alternative reimbursement models. You get the kind of idea. It will take me too long to go through each one. There are all these buzzwords that we use in our sort of day-to-day interactions in the system. And the important point I wanted to make there was, you know, again, without going through each one, make sure that they're not just terms of jargon that you've read in the paper. Don't just give them lip service. I want to convince you that we have a role to play in improving our system, not just thinking about, you know, how much contribution should go up or how this benefit should change or that benefit should change. But certainly in my career, it's been a privilege to be able to be at the coalface of either, a healthcare provider or an administrator or a medical scheme and understand how the advice we give, not only in the sort of more vanilla areas of benefit design, contribution increases, et cetera, but on how we get medical schemes to think about their contracting, how we get them to think about what the effective benefits might have on fragmentation of care, how we get them to think about even building their systems, how to deal with their data, how to deal with their reports, how to risk stratify their members so that they can apply what, you know, limited resources they have from a managed care and effectiveness of care point of view correctly and accurately and efficiently. The degree to which preventative care is emphasized, all of these other things, we as healthcare actuaries can have an influence on that. And so it's incumbent on us to apply our minds carefully, not just in the sort of abstract technical 3,000 feet above perspective, but to understand that our input and our decisions and our advice in these environments has a massive influence on the way that schemes design their benefits, on the way that they contract with providers, on the way that they engage their patients. We should take that responsibility seriously. I wanted to talk a little bit about policy now, if you'll indulge me, just to sort of take a little bit of a step back, reflecting on COVID, reflecting on some other thinking, because as it turns out, health insurance, medical schemes are actually only a very small part of what we need for a sustainable health system and a thriving society. Stealing some ideas on data visualization from Hans Rosling, I put this together just to mark South Africa's trajectory, looking at life expectancy at birth and GDP per capita. Now, again, you know, the kind of points Emil made earlier about correlation and causation are on point. This is not a straight line correlation, but economies are life support systems. You know, a thriving economy means people have access to basic services, et cetera, et cetera. Let me play this out so you can have a look. The red dot is South Africa. So you can see we're making our way up, not necessarily growing much GDP per capita, but certainly increasing our life expectancy from the mid-50s. As we get to the 80s and 90s, unfortunately, HIV takes its hold. We weren't the only country affected. Many other countries were affected, but we certainly made the worst policy choices. And you can see the effect that that has. Over the course of the next 10 to 15 years, we essentially lost all of the life expectancy gains that we made. And only now, in the last 10 to 15 years or so, have managed to claw our way back up to the life expectancy that we had before the HIV epidemic took its hold on us. So a couple of points. Firstly, policy makes a difference. Lots of other countries were affected by HIV. But we, by far, by some measure, had the crappiest HIV response policy, and many of us lived through that in horror. But not only that, once you've got a good policy, implementation makes a difference. So this is a situation where, you know, we may have turned around our policy response, but being able to deliver on it, being able to effect that policy is what makes the difference climbing up. If we had just had a policy and no implementation, we would still have been ambling down here in the mid-50s. So now we're back up to 65 or so. If you take HIV out and you know, if you put our HIV prevalence to where it is in many other countries, in the low single digits, this is about 5 to 6 years off of our life expectancy, that HIV. So it put us almost back in the mix, but not quite. Overall, HIV and the poor policy response set us back 20 years, both in life expectancy improvements, and in economic development. We should be about there. We should be, in the mix of our GDP contemporaries, maybe not as high as Thailand, Peru, et cetera. I mean, look at the other countries here, Libya, et cetera, Guatemala. I mean, we should be right in the mix here. should have a life expectancy overall in the mid-70s. And from a GDP point of view, we should be up here. And this, you know, all sorts of reasons why we're not. It's a good macroeconomic question. I won't delve into that too much, but for all sorts of reasons. But this is the trajectory that so many other countries have followed, and we've fallen behind. And a health policy response is at least one reason for that. The macroeconomics are a problem. You know, and again, just having had the opportunity to step a little bit back and think about the healthcare system overall, our problem is not only located within the healthcare system. We are on very shaky ground from a macroeconomic point of view. Extraordinarily slow GDP growth over the long term, massive, massive unemployment, and massive inequality, 55% below the upper bound poverty line. And I encourage you, whenever I give a talk like this, I encourage you to think about that maths, that 55% of our population are living under 1,335 rand per person per month. Now, that has a direct effect when you study health economics, which we don't cover that well in the actuarial health syllabus, on the so-called social determinants of health, or all of the non-health things that affect our healthcare. Employment, income, water and sanitation, massive issue, secure housing, massive issue, what's going on in your neighborhood and community, access to proper food and education. All of these things have an overwhelmingly large effect on the state of health of a community or a province or a country, much, much more so than whatever health financing structure you can put on them. And so, you know, we should not ignore what influence we can have, even if small, on these kinds of areas. So if our aim is to try to help the system improve and strengthen, it should not only be on the financing side. The health system operates within that context that mirrors the underlying economy. People moan all the time about our inequitous healthcare system. But how could it not be when it sits on a structural inequality in the system? The health system, it would be very difficult to make the health system the lever with which to fix and improve overall equity in the system. Equity is desirable, not only in healthcare, but also in education, in safety, in, you know, access to housing, access to transport, access to safe and effective nutrition, transport, etc. But which one of those should be none of those can be the single lever with which we improve equity. And sometimes in the rhetoric around NHI and universal health coverage, it's put that way to say it's our health system, the inequity in the health system holding us back, which is not the case. Improving equity in the health system is not going to improve close to 50% employment, 60% in the youth. Improving the healthcare system isn't going to fix that problem. It is an important problem to fix along with the macroeconomic situation, but important, I think, to remember that that's the context within which the health system is operating. A little bit quickly on COVID, because I mean, it's so much still prevalent in the history. And I was thinking recently about this concept of excess deaths, which got so much attention over the period because of the confirmed deaths, excess deaths debate. I didn't put the 2019 statistics here again. When I was thinking about this, I thought I might be in the room. But the previous years, you know, number of deaths, when you look, would be anything from 450 to the low 500s, 1,000 deaths in South Africa. So pre-COVID, you would expect the, call it 500,000. We just saw these massive, massively increased numbers, as we know, looking at the excess death figures. So here, using the SAMRC report, but the reason I wanted to show this is because a penny dropped for me when I was thinking about, okay, but what's in this expected number? You know, the way that this model works is it takes a few years of history and says, okay, well, that's what we would expect in an ordinary year. And then said, okay, well, we had these massive increases in deaths, and that's mostly because of COVID. But what's in the baseline? Why must we take for granted, you know, that baseline is correct? Going back to the sort of story graph that I had earlier, you know, one of the outcomes we like to pat ourselves on the back for is that we have the largest HIV program in the world. Fantastic. Is that really the prize that you should be going for? That you handled the HIV policy so badly that now you're giving more, we're giving more HIV medication to any other country in the world when we're not by any stretch, you know, in the most populous country in the world. And so, you know, this is not really the prize you want to win. It signals a massive policy failure that, yes, because of what we're spending on medication and significant donor programs, we've been able to level off our experience from an HIV point of view. So the question is, you know, what's in this baseline of mortality, and have we become complacent about it? Just comparing the history, taking the data from StatsSA, this is an interesting piece of side analysis to do. The mortality data from StatsSA is less than the mortality, overall mortality data coming out of the South African Medical Research Council, in the order of sort of 40,000 deaths a year. And so that's another interesting piece of analysis to think about. I haven't gone into it here. Point I wanted to make here, if you remember from the previous graph where last year's number of deaths was in the 700s, that's by far, and over this long period of time, and I'm sure extends back even further because of the trajectory here, that 2021 was the worst mortality year in South African history, including at the height of HIV and AIDS. So there are still some that sort of want to brush COVID under the carpet as not a, you know, significant thing or a bad flu, etc. I mean, our experience in South Africa has been absolutely the opposite. You know, the worst mortality we've experienced in our history. Moving on to other topics, HIV and COVID set aside, just looking at, again, the causes of death published by StatsSA. Now, we know this is not entirely accurate because of the causes of death. The latest one is 2018, because we have this ridiculous regulatory environment where they only open the second cause of death certificate like sometime later. So we're always behind the curve in understanding what's driving our burden of disease and driving our mortality rate. So TB is up there, but that's highly correlated with HIV. But you can see the prevalence of non-communicable disease. They also have a very interesting statistic slide like this, with statistics by race, which show that NCDs by far affect white South Africans more so than infectious diseases, communicable diseases, and the reverse is true for our black citizens. And so there is a lot of work to do still on both infectious disease and non-communicable disease, because that's creeping up across the board, will probably soon overwhelm even TB and HIV from a burden of mortality and morbidity point of view. So in other words, we need to step up our game here for those of us that are in the healthcare system. The point I wanted to get across is, let's not become complacent about what's baked into our baseline mortality. So, take it for granted. Okay, well, 400, 500,000 South Africans are going to die every year. Don't take that for granted. We must keep applying pressure, keep applying our efforts and our brain power and intellect to improve health and wellness within that population, if we're going to improve both in life expectancy, wellness, and along the GDP curve. So, from the IHME, I pulled top 10 drivers of death and disability in South Africa. So when we think about COVID and the terrible effect it had, we thought, okay, well, what should we do to prevent that? And then we can apply that same kind of logic to all of these other drivers to improve our system, to get better. And I thought I would come up with some suggestions. Here, you know, unsafe sex, we can go for abstinence, mandate condom use, like we mandated masks. Malnutrition, we should absolutely ban fast food, soft drinks for people that can't afford. This is actually a really good idea. I thought if we could find a way to give airplane food, terrible as it is, but for people that, I mean, it's a nice ready-made warm meal. For people with high BMI, maybe we should do weight-based pricing for all sorts of things. Maybe we should remove sugar from the food supply completely. It's within the government's power to do that. We should say there should be mandatory yoga programs. We should absolutely outlaw tobacco and alcohol use. We should force everybody to walk and ride bicycles, ban petrol cars. We should give prescribed meals to people with only ingredients that we say. And we should get rid of this absolutely terrible that this is making the top 10 perpetrators of intimate partner violence. Of course, we can't do that. Terrible ideas. Because that's not the society we live in. We don't do that. Not only do we not do that as a society, because we value agency and we value, people's own intelligence, independence, decision making, and personal agency. But also they don't work. And so we have to find other ways to solve these kind of problems. Education is key. It's not the only thing to do, but when you try to force people to do things or not to do things, you really don't get anywhere. So education remains the key strategy for unsafe sex, for malnutrition. We have to, I think, be much more aggressive on food subsidies. It's this terrible situation we have, almost like the Hunger Games, where we have, districts out in the outskirts that are like really suffering with terrible malnutrition. And in our urban centers, having 7-course tasting meals, with food that's concentrated and distilled so much, to have a tiny little bite to eat, use like 17 oranges to get this particular flavor of orange juice. It really is a tragedy, and we need to think of a better way to do that. I'm not advocating at all for socialism and everybody should have the same. I'm just saying that's a big problem that we need to solve. Given the role of food in all of these issues, malnutrition, high BMI, blood pressure, fasting glucose, etc. Probably, I would say, the question was put to me some months ago. I would say that fixing our food issue would be priority number one for the country as a whole in terms of healthcare. I think obviously, aside from carrying on with people's HIV treatment, but getting people to eat healthily, eat enough to solve the malnutrition problem, and eat the right food to solve the overnutrition problem has got to be priority number one. Tobacco and alcohol use, I would probably advocate for stronger regulation there, because that makes the most sense to me. At the very least, I would say these agents that sell these products should take much more responsibility for the causal effect that their products have. Every alcoholism program in the country should be paid for by, I think, the industry. I think there should be a study in public health about how much lung cancer, emphysema, other types of cancers associated with tobacco use cause, and the tobacco industry should pay for those. In total, they need to immunize the system from the effect of their product. That would be fair, I would think. You can't have your cake and eat it if you want to sell these products or participate. Lots of data on air pollution at the moment. We drink a liter of water a day. We breathe 16 liters of air a day or something like that. I saw a statistic recently. And yet we're much fussier about our water than our air. I think partly because in South Africa, we are blessed relative to some more developed markets. If you go to Hong Kong, London, etc., then you really feel it if you're there for a long time. But it is an issue. And it was brought into attention specifically during COVID, once eventually the WHO recognized that COVID was airborne and not surface transmitted. And so people started monitoring carbon dioxide levels in the workplace and those kind of things, which is important. Dietary risks and intimate partner violence is, a real enigma. That's just a tragedy for us that this is in the top 10. I don't have easy answers for that one. But I think, critical that we find some solutions there also. Certainly must not be ignored. So just some spitballing of ideas. And again, not necessarily traditional actuarial work, but if you can think about these kind of things in your work, I think it will help you give better advice and give better input into your environments. So just a couple of last slides then with my views on some solutions. Firstly, government should buy local. I'm talking now about the macroeconomic situation, picture that I painted. Our government doesn't buy local, including in the healthcare sector. You know, probably half of our HIV medication, of which, as I said, is the largest program in the world, half of those drugs are imported. They don't need to be imported. We have the manufacturing capacity here. If they're bought here, there would be more jobs, more tax in the tax pool, more people able to contribute an NHI tax or a social security tax or contribute to a medical scheme, etc. And they should provide incentives for corporate South Africa to do the same. There are currently no incentive for that. If you look at a long-term review of our macroeconomy, we've done terrible, you know, we're importing things we should be able to produce locally, and we're exporting things at way too low a level of development. So we're exporting way too much raw material as opposed to enhanced goods, for example. And this is just like a recipe for financial disaster for us. This is a sort of hobby interest of mine, that we need a paradigm shift from passive to act, from a passive approach to an active approach for job creation. We need to give jobs that match the skills we have right now, but we need to develop the skills to match the jobs of the future. And you have to do both of these at the same time, because we've already lost one round of our demographic dividend, sort of this first wave of young people that came through into young adulthood. And you can see the unemployment stats we have amongst the youth. And we risk missing the next demographic dividend if we don't give them appropriate skills. In the public sector, we need to improve the budget. Lots of people talk about, fix the holes in the sieve and then we'll give you more money. You need to do both. It's not just one or the other. More budget would be more health personnel, better maintained facilities, etc. The budget is very low. If you compare that to medical scheme premiums, you'll realize, you know, it's 4 to 5 times less than a medical scheme premium. Now, when you're doing your costing for your next budget projection, you know, try work with a fifth of the budget you have and see what benefits you're able to provide. So we shouldn't just assume that the public sector can do extraordinary things with such limited resources. They do need more money. The way that managers are appointed, the way that they're trained, and the way that they're held accountable needs to improve dramatically. We're still in a world where there's really no accountability after life Esedimeni and the massive tragedy. And there are many, many stories like that. That was just the one that made the headlines. You need much more education on across the board, on behavior, good habits, bad habits, on food, safe sex, air quality. And overall, as a country, I think as a health sector and as a country, we need to overcome our complacency with, this is just, you know, how we live now, get used to it and compensate for it. We need then practical partnerships with NGOs in the private sector. And COVID was a fantastic example of some of those. It was a great experience, exhausting as it was, to be at the coalface of some of those with some of the NGOs, seeing the private sector work together with government. The work rate of people on both sides was just absolutely phenomenal to watch. If we can not necessarily keep up that pace, but keep up that open engagement, I think we'll be well placed for the future. And then on the private sector side, again, I think there's enormous complacency. The frustration is there, but you know, there's been so much of batting our heads over the last 20 years. You know, we tend to have fatigue, like regulatory fatigue. If you looked at a presentation of mine 10 years ago, it would have said similar things about the kind of reforms we need, and we just haven't made any progress. But it's important that we remain committed to pushing for the reforms that we think are necessary for a sustainable environment. We need to embrace value-based care. I'm talking about it as a concept. Lots of detail and lots of different ways that it can manifest. Some work and some don't. But the ideas embedded there are useful, and it should be embraced as a principle, and the details worked out in each particular case. There is interesting talk about health professionals and the current model. It's quite unique, the model we have with, you know, radiology, pathology not being part of corporatized healthcare services and doctors working so independently. Lots of other countries have different models, or at least have the flexibility to try different models, employment, employed, contracted, you know, included in bundled fees, all of these kind of things. And so we need to be part of those conversations, to understand health professionals and their role, help them think about risk management, help them think about incentives and where they can fit in. And the last point I would make, which is, you know, not something that the industry has spoken about much, but certainly has been our experience over the last little while, is that there is a structural problem with not allowing medical schemes in their own right to be able to build in behavior improvement incentives and strong wellness programs. I'm not talking about health days and preventative care, et cetera. I'm talking about allowing medical schemes to be able to put incentives on the table to improve behavior, because otherwise they just become catastrophic risk pools, you know, sort of third party payer, arm's length. Oh, well, I had an incident and now pay me. And then their purpose becomes only, you know, this catastrophic protection idea and play no role in sustainability of those risk pools. And so, you know, that environment is what we call keeping score of a losing game. Because we know that the demand is insatiable, because that it's at least partly discretionary, because we know incentives aren't aligned at the moment, etc. It's actually important to be able to build those kind of mechanisms into the risk pool so that not only the catastrophic protection is there, but also that they're more sustainable. And so we think that's a conversation that's worth having over the next little while. And that's all I wanted to share today. So I'm happy to stick around and take your questions.
Many thanks, Barry. It's clear you're quite passionate about the subject. We slightly ran over time, so
apologies.
So I think we can take one question from the online and one from the audience. There is a question from Beauty, and she says, "Are there any ways that you think that the public and private healthcare systems in SA collaborated well during the pandemic, outside of the obvious or more visible things like vaccination?" I think she's maybe referring to how hospital beds were shared and so on. Is there any way we could have taken that could have been taken forward to improve the way the healthcare system operates in the absence of health reforms?
An interesting question. So there were a few examples. There was outside of the vaccination, which was a massive campaign, by the way. And you know, the mediocre performance in the campaign, I don't think, should be attributed to poor private public partnership. All sorts of other reasons why. But in terms of the muscle of the private sector and public sector working together, playing to their strengths, the effort was monumental. It was extraordinary to see. I've never seen anything like it in 20 years. There were other examples, like we did some work on the financing side. So if patients had to move one between the other, maybe if a public hospital was full, you know, and had to go to a private hospital, how would that financing work? That was tricky to do, to get right, actually. There are lots of bureaucracy, lots of complexity there, but with many late night conversations, we got somewhere. In the end, it wasn't needed, but it was a useful channel of communication. I think probably the most useful, practical, like grassroots, intervention was that the between public and private, they formed a hospital bed bureau, which was how many beds are available per region so that patients who needed care could be sent to hospitals where there were available beds, and it prevented this idea of overflowing. And it was certainly one of the more practical interventions that helped smooth out the experience of COVID, as opposed to everybody rushing to one hospital and being sent away. There were some of that experience, but this idea of the bed bureau was a very good idea, and I hope that it'll be maintained. Outside of that, going forward, sure, I don't know. There was good relationship building, and I hope that will be maintained. What I'm worried about is that NHI and the focus back now on NHI will bring back the animosity, some of the animosity, and bring back some of the differences of opinion on how health reform should advance. It's hard to say. I mean, but I know that good relationships were built. So it definitely helped build some of the trust between the parties, but yeah, from what I can see, some tension remains. So there's a lot of work to do there still.
Thanks for that. Lusani, thank you.
I've got 10 questions.
Just you are welcome to ask them.
No, I won't ask
them. You've got my email address, Lusani.
A couple of times you spoke about that in the 2000s, there was a lot more rigor in engaging on regulatory issues, and that seems to have gone away. I want you to just talk about how that can be reignited. That's question number one. And that I refer to the progressive regulatory reform that you refer to, value-based care, and I think also the wellness component. Point number two, the food subsidies one. I think that would make us very relevant as a society, a rural society, if we were to come out publicly with such a proposal, because that is not something that would be expected of us. We look more like champions for private sector, pretty much. So I must congratulate you in the way you have expanded your thinking, especially when it has to do with the public sector or the rest of the people. I mean, I think at times one feels, you know, to concentrate all this intellect on trying to solve problems for, I don't know what, 10% of the population sounds at times like 15. A waste. Well, you know, like a waste, 15, 16, give or take. So today you've really applied your mind to broader issues in a very interesting way, and I'm keen to take you up on that. And one that particularly stood out is the one about food subsidies. I'm not sure if you've had it, you've thought a little bit more about that, and maybe there are better solutions. But I think if we can put our minds to such issues, and this is an example, and get a conversation going around this, I think this could really, you know, put us out in a way that is quite relevant. And so I just want to commend you for the thinking. I think my time has been well spent here today because of, amongst other things, your presentation on these things. Thank you, Barry.
Very kind, Lusani. Thank you. On the regulatory engagement question, look, it's a few things. I think I would probably, it's a long conversation, but let me make two points. The one is there was a clear regulatory mandate in the early 2000s. As I said, you know, it was, as medical schemes were going to be the underpin for social health insurance, it was necessary for them to be set up and regulated in a particular way. And we spent the latter part of the 90s and the early part of the 2000s figuring out how to do that and maintain those tensions. So there was a regulatory clarity and trajectory that no one really argued with. I mean, it was contentious, but we got to grips with it at the time. The second one was capacity, technical capacity at the time. So, you know, what we would call policy supporting technical work, the kind of stuff that Heather McLeod used to do and Alex van den Heever used to do, was just like massively instrumental in how we thought about the healthcare system, tackling the issues. These things were not uncontroversial. We engaged heavily at the time. You know, we disagreed vehemently with each other. But there was something to grapple with. And there were position papers that were debated and put out. And, you know, there were rigorous debates about the best way to proceed. And, you know, tightly contested negotiations on how things should be structured, etc. And we worked through all of that over the first sort of 5 to 10 years of the reform. And post 2007, that stopped. 100% came to a grinding halt because that wasn't where the policy attention was anymore. So the capacity that was required to carry on that work left those environments, and all the focus was on NHI, and there we've been ambling around from a policy point of view for the better part of 15 years. The food is fascinating. I mean, that's another discussion all on its own. I think it solves lots of problems. My team would tell you every now and then I get excited about this kind of these kind of weird, strange ideas. But, I mean, we have a massive agricultural opportunity in South Africa. We have lots of arable land. You could create massive jobs and improve food security, grow the right things, put the right food on the table, get rid of the sweet aisles as you leave. I mean, you know, we've got like all of the behavioral science things being used against the helpless populace, you know. You go to, I don't want to throw anyone under the bus here, but Dis-Chem and Clicks, for example, you know, our pharmacies, we were getting our medicine. What do you buy on the way out? Chocolates and sweets. You know, you pick up your diabetic medication and you walk through the sweet aisle to pay for it. I mean, it's the most absurd thing, just for an example. Then you've got a country like the Netherlands, which is this tiny little, you know, seafaring country in Northern Europe. They produce, they're the biggest producer of fruit and vegetables in Europe. Export in that tiny little country. Now, why can we not, you know, find out how they're doing it? Bring that kind of technology here in some kind of partnership, massively improve our food supply. You know, and yeah, fix things from the bottom up, the grassroots, as it were.
Yeah, many thanks for that, Barry, and thank you for preparing the presentation and sharing your thoughts. At least we now know that Lusani is a happy man.